Hello, everybody, and welcome to That Millennial Life, a podcast where I talk to millennials about their lives and how they are managing young adulthood. Today, later on the podcast, you will hear a conversation I had with Stephanie Damiano. Steph went to college with my brother at Montclair State University and has had a lot of success since she was a child as a model. I talked to her about how she got started doing modeling work, about some of the experiences she's had in the industry, about some of the success she's also had as an actress, and about how she managed to balance all of that, her show business career, with her college education. But before I get to the interview, I want to talk about something that may take a while, definitely quite longer than the usual introductions that I do, so I want to prepare you all for that. However, I think that what I am about to talk about is important. Normally in my introductions, I offer my thoughts on a topic that is talked about in the interview that follows that I think is worth expanding upon. However, in this episode, that will not be the case. Make no mistake, I want to continue to make the primary focus of the show about the interviews and the different guests I have on, while using the introductions to talk about my individual thoughts briefly. However, in this rare instance, I want to utilize this platform of my podcast to talk about something that, as I said, will require more time but that I feel passionate about. To even call it an introduction would be inaccurate, as it will take up a significant chunk of the episode. So I want to offer my apologies to Steph, as I don't mean to give off the impression that our conversation is any less important than the other conversations that I had. So please, to my listener, stick around after I offer my thoughts and listen to that interview. Okay, so what I want to talk about is a topic that I have only briefly talked about on the podcast before, but has been a major topic of conversation in pop culture in the past year or so that I believe to be extremely relevant to my generation, to college students, and to the college campus culture. The topic that I am referring to is the PC, or politically correct phenomenon, or politically correct agenda that has been primarily associated with young people or college students as the people who are attempting to carry out said agenda. And the reason that I am bringing up this topic is because of a connection between it and a guest that I very much so wanted to have on the podcast. This person is a young woman who went to the same college as I did, Quinnipiac University, and was in the same graduating class as I was. I invited her to come on my podcast 4 months ago, and for the past 4 months, I have periodically been in contact with her for the purpose of trying to schedule when we could arrange for us to get together, throughout which time she communicated to me having interest in relation to the idea of her being a guest, only to have her a week ago respond to my most recent attempt to arrange us getting together by saying that she was no longer interested. I will get to the reasons she communicated as to why she was no longer interested a bit later. Now, this young woman's name is Lexi Gruber. Lexi is someone who throughout her time at college frequently utilized Facebook as a platform to speak out about incidents that happened in the Quinnipiac community or in broader society that she identified as social, cultural, or racial injustices. I shouldn't just say throughout her time at college, as she has continued to since graduating college, and may have before college as well. I don't know. Also, I am choosing to say her name because a lot of the information I am about to provide has been written about by several other sources that include her name, so I see no reason as to why I cannot say her name. There is a significant amount of people from the Quinnipiac community, faculty, staff, and students who went to school around the time that I did, who know who she is. In my opinion, many more people know of her than the average student. The reason for this is because her efforts in speaking out against cultural and racial insensitivity on campus would often be a source of attention and a source of contention between people in the campus community. So to my listeners who are aware of the incidents that I am about to talk about, I apologize. However, I want to provide some history to some of my listeners who are unaware of what occurred so that after, when I give my opinion, it has context. But before I do, at this point, you as listeners may be thinking, why does Joe feel compelled to speak out about this one person specifically? As I said, the incidents involving Lexi at my school would often be a significant source of attention and interest by my peers. However, the majority of the opinions of disagreement that were expressed toward her on social media were hostile, and thus disregarded as legitimate. Also, I feel as if utilizing social media as an outlet to express an opinion is limiting, so I want to utilize this as an outlet to be more elaborate. In the past, I have chosen not to publicly share opinions I had while at college because I feared that speaking in disagreement of someone who promotes cultural sensitivity would in turn make me look insensitive and damage my reputation on campus. When one speaks in contention of political correctness, one runs the risk of being associated with people of the likes of Donald Trump, who somehow views the opposite of political correctness as it being okay to promote physical violence. But please, do not associate me with that bloviating, fascist, racist, narcissistic demagogue, or anyone else who speaks out against political correctness in superficial ways. So anyway, I chose not to get involved in the past. Also, I have privately heard opinions of disagreement expressed towards Lexi who were also afraid to publicly express them. And I believe that although some of the opinions that I heard are ones of disagreement, I have found them to be intelligent and worth being heard. So I feel compelled to utilize my platform to finally give a voice to the opinions that I've heard expressed by so many of my peers about issues that they view as important. However, I shouldn't speak for anyone else, so any opinions I express from here on out are strictly my own. You may also be asking, why is talking about these incidents involving this young woman relevant in a more broad sense? Why should anyone who does not have any association with the community that the incidents are relevant to care? As I said, I think the topic of political correctness is extremely relevant to my generation in the college campus culture, which is the focus of the show. Everyone is aware of the prevalence of safe zones at several universities that are used as an outlet to discuss cultural sensitivity, and of the stigma associated with millennials and contemporary college students for being too sensitive. I have no personal issue with cultural sensitivity. However, I often disagree with the manner in which the majority of the people in my generation utilize social media to be critical of cultural insensitivity. I believe that the incidents that I will be talking about are representative of that. I will elaborate on that more later. Listeners may also be asking, does Joe have a personal vendetta against this young woman? Is he attempting to smear her reputation? The answer to both of those questions is no. I simply want to voice my opinion about incidents and topics that are important to my generation, to my peers, and to me. I will attempt to be diplomatic and respectful. Okay, now to provide some information about incidents that transpired. One incident involved a poster that was made by a sorority at QU for a philanthropy event called Queso for Casa. That was an event in which Mexican-style food, from Moe's, I believe, was sold on campus with the intent of having the profits donated to an organization called CASA, or Court-Appointed Special Advocates for Children, an organization that supports and promotes court-appointed volunteer advocacy for abused and neglected children. The poster was posted on Facebook as one of the members of the sorority's profile picture, and it featured a picture of maracas, which the sorority included in the poster with the intention of it being something that is associated with Mexican culture, to go along with the theme of serving Mexican food. This resulted in Lexi commenting on the profile picture with saying, quote, "As a Latina student at Quinnipiac, I find this incredibly offensive. Maracas are not a Mexican instrument, and had there been cultural sensitivity, that would have been understood. And when you appropriate culture, which was done here, it's offensive. It should also be noted that nearly 40% of foster children are Hispanic, and it may be wise to be culturally sensitive to the population you are serving," unquote. It should be noted that I only chose to mention a sample of Lexi's comments on the picture and not everything that she said in entirety. Also, Lexi was a foster child herself and has done a lot of great work for the foster care system and has even spoke in front of Congress about how the education system supports foster children. Lexi also took to Twitter to speak out against the poster with a tweet saying, quote, "Philanthropy with a side of cultural appropriation and stereotypes. So shameful," unquote. But anyway, after Lexi posted her dissent of the poster, arguments transpired, with people replying to her post trying to make her realize that even if the picture of maracas appropriates Mexican culture, that they obviously had no intention of it being offensive or stereotypical. Ultimately, the event was canceled due to a decision made by the sorority saying, quote, that they realized that the poster was offensive and that as a sorority, they don't stand for discrimination and wanted to cancel the event with the intention of revamping it so that it will not be offensive to anyone on campus. Unquote. and that was an excerpt taken from The Chronicle, the Quinnipiac student newspaper. After the event's cancellation and the student body became aware of what transpired, a significant amount of the student body responded through social media in disagreement. And, as I said, a significant amount of the disagreement toward Lexi was, to put it lightly, hostile, or malicious, or mean. It was mean. On an app called Yik Yak, where people can anonymously create and view discussion threads of users within a 5-mile radius, several people wrote posts that can be viewed as threats or harassment. This resulted in Lexi going to Hamden Police, stating that she was afraid for her safety. In an article written by The Chronicle, Lexi was quoted in saying, quote, "I've gotten a threat to my physical safety, people who have wanted to find my address. What they saw as simple silencing is so much more than that. It's a really sad day to be a bobcat. I'm really ashamed to call these people my peers." Unquote. So this incident resulted in it being covered by several news outlets, such as The Chronicle, The New York Daily News, The National Review, Barstool, Fox 61, NBC Connecticut, Total Frat Move, as well as several others. So that's that. I also wanted to talk about another incident involving Lexi that I think is worth mentioning and is indirectly relevant to me. There is currently a comedy show that is being produced at Quinnipiac by the student television station Q30 called Quinnipiac Tonight that used to be the show that I hosted, Late Night with Joe Cole, before it got changed to the current show that it is against my will. But I'm not bitter about it. You know, I've talked about it on the show before, but we're not here to talk about me. So in October, the show produced a video called Orphans Weekend, which was comprised of students who were a part of the show approaching parents on campus who were there attending Parents Weekend, acting childishly, asking them if they were their parents, if they could be their parents, with the intent of capturing with hidden cameras the confused reactions or whatever other type of reaction that a parent may have. After the episode that featured this video debuted online, Lexi wrote a Facebook post saying, quote, "Just when you thought Quinnipiac University couldn't get any more ignorant, they've taken it to a whole other level. Student media decided to make a satire about students on campus without families by following, quote-unquote, orphans around during Parents and Family Weekend. There is nothing funny about students without parents. I was one of those, quote-unquote, orphans that this sick and twisted video openly mocks. There was nothing funny about my predicament or the challenges faced by similar students. How dare someone be so cruel and heartless to see humor in our hopelessness? This disgusting, cruel, and unintelligent video is beyond reproach, and I am ashamed of the students that sought to make this parody." Unquote. This resulted in Lexi starting an online petition that people can sign as an official condemnation of the video, asking for an official apology from Quinnipiac University. The goal of the petition is 500 signatures and currently has 295. The video is still viewable online. So, these are just two examples of several incidents in which Lexi utilized social media to be critical of the insensitivity of Quinnipiac students. Okay, now I am going to take off my journalist hat of providing you all with information and put on my pundit hat and give you my opinion about all of this. Well, I guess a pundit is an expert who gives an opinion, so I don't mean to claim to be that. I am just a person with an opinion. But before I say anything, I want to say that I see myself as a liberal-minded person, especially when it comes to social issues. When it comes to fiscal issues, I have no idea what's going on. I have been utilizing Stav and podcasts to try to learn, but anyway. Okay, first let's talk about this Orphans Weekend video and quickly talk about why I believe the PC agenda has been diminishing or compromising, possibly unintentionally, comedy. Let's get that out of the way. I watched the video, obviously, and from a comedy standpoint, it didn't land for me. I didn't find it particularly funny. There was maybe a part or two that I found amusing, but humor is relative, so that's just my opinion. However, it seems obvious to me that the makers of the video in no way had any malicious intent or intended for orphans to be the butt of the joke. It is my opinion that to say that the video is a, quote, "satire about students on campus without families," unquote, is a bit of a stretch. Satire is defined as using humor or exaggeration or ridicule to criticize people's stupidity or immoral behavior in the context of politics or other topical issues. I do not believe this to be a video about a topical issue. I do not believe that the makers of the video were using humor to mock the stupidity of orphans or to mock orphans in general. I think they intended for the humor to come from, as I said, the reaction that parents would make to students asking them to be their parents. Not even to make parents the butt of the joke, because I don't think they were attempting to make a mockery of the parents, just to playfully mess with them. So I do not believe that there was any malicious intent towards orphans specifically. However, I understand that an argument can be made that the intentions that the creators of the video had do not matter. It could still come off as offensive even if they didn't intend to mock orphans. However, to call the video sick, twisted, cruel, disgusting, and heartless, in my opinion, is a bit excessive. Now, in terms of all comedy in general, it is my opinion that the recent PC agenda has been undermining creative people's First Amendment rights. In an episode of Mark Maron's podcast, during his interview with Adam McKay, they talk about how in the 1950s and 1960s, liberals fought for First Amendment rights in comedy. They talk about how comedians, most of who are liberal or progressives or at least centrists, fought for First Amendment rights and the right to say anything, and about how now the liberal agenda has been attempting to stifle that. Comedians like Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock, as well as several others, have spoken out in contention of political correctness's effect on comedy and how they will no longer perform at colleges because contemporary college students are too sensitive. People always say that there is a gray area between what's funny and what's offensive. However, I believe there to be a pretty identifiable divide between whether humor has deliberate malicious intent or not. If something is created that is clearly malicious, then I believe it should be condemned. However, I do not believe that the Orphans Weekend video falls under this category. If something is created that seems to contain unintentional offensive undertones, which is how some people may understandably categorize this Orphans Weekend video, I believe it is the responsibility of people who would speak out in disagreement of it to highlight why they think it is offensive, but empathize with the notion that the offensive nature of it may not have stemmed from purposeful malicious intentions, but rather stem from pure ignorance. If this is the case, I do not believe that it is appropriate to publicly defy or shame the creators. Now, let's talk about political correctness in a broader sense and its connection to my wanting to have Lexi on the podcast. It was my hope to have her on the podcast to have a conversation about the politically correct agenda and her personal connection to it, as I believe it is, as I've said, an important conversation to have. I wanted to ask her about what compels or inspires her to speak out about cultural issues, especially on social media. What is the true reason she utilizes social media to highlight and criticize the cultural insensitivity of her peers? Also, I wanted to ask her opinion on why she believes that her attempts in highlighting insensitivity would often cause a significant amount of the student body to respond in opposition. Now, in regards to the question of what drives her pursuits, or what generally drives the pursuits of people involved with the politically correct agenda on social media, through my research about this issue, I have heard associations made in regards to what inclines people on social media to criticize insensitivity, to having a superiority complex and finding pleasure in the idea of taking a position of virtue. I've heard people attribute it to a response to powerlessness, someone not having power or liberation in the past, and how their efforts are now an attempt to have a position of power. I've heard it be attributed to having a pathological desire for validation, or for attention, all of this being a reason as to why some people utilize social media to speak out and criticize cultural insensitivity rather than genuinely caring about the issues. Now, I am not attempting to infer that any of these reasons are why Lexi is compelled to do what she does, because in all fairness, I don't know what compels her to do what she does, which is something I wanted to ask her on my podcast. In the past, I have unfairly privately communicated to people reasons I projected as to why she does what she does, and unfairly associated with her the idea of it being a response to powerlessness, from the thinking of, oh, she was in the foster care system, to a degree maybe she didn't have a certain amount of control over what happened to her in life and yearned to fix it, so now she does what she does because maybe she has a subconscious, or perhaps conscious, desire to fix the ignorance and injustice that she sees. Also, even though for the most part I didn't partake in the abundance of malicious attacks towards her from students at my school, I want to be fair and mention that I did reply to one of her tweets by saying that I believe that she does what she does all for the attention. However, I deleted the tweet almost immediately. I've had the thought, why does she have to speak out against people on social media on a public platform? Couldn't she just have contacted the sorority privately so they were not publicly embarrassed? Does she choose to do this publicly because she superficially wants people to be aware of her efforts? Although it is my opinion that a lot of people in my generation use social media as a platform to speak out about their opinions because of these superficial reasons, it's unfair to attribute those reasons to her specifically. So, I have unfairly assumed reasons in regards to what compels her to do what she does, which is why, as I said, I wanted to have her on my podcast, so I can ask her, instead of assume. Now, in regards to the other question that I wanted to ask her about why she believes that her attempts in highlighting the insensitivity of her peers would often cause a significant amount of the student body to respond in opposition, I have my own opinion as to why I think that happened, and I believe that it is the same reason as to why I and other people generally have negative reactions toward people in my generation who utilize social media to be critical of cultural insensitivity. It is my opinion that the language that Lexi uses to criticize cultural insensitivity is oftentimes disrespectful. It is my opinion, and everything I'm about to say is just my opinion, it is my opinion that she fails to show respect or empathy or acknowledgement for the other side of the argument. It is my opinion that she has posted on social media unfair generalizations about Quinnipiac students and has been unfairly critical of Quinnipiac students. It is my opinion that she uses harsh language and belittles people who are unaware of their insensitivity. It's the whole idea of shaming. She uses language like saying things are shameful or saying QU students should be ashamed. Shaming doesn't work. It isn't effective. If you want to bring people together and educate them on their ignorance and hopefully inspire change, making them feel ashamed will not do that. Shaming causes people to recoil back into their original belief systems as a defense mechanism. It has the same effect as bullying. It isolates people. Instead, if you want to enact real change, one should empathize with people's ignorance, especially if it is benign, and respectfully attempt to make them realize why you believe they are wrong. And me saying this is not just a response to Lexi, as it is my opinion that a lot of people who utilize social media to criticize cultural insensitivity, especially from my generation, fail to display empathy. So to anyone in my generation who takes to social media to speak out against cultural insensitivity, I hope you agree with me that criticizing people isn't effective, and to make sure that your efforts in speaking out about what you believe to be insensitive are not opportunistic, and are worth the contentious response that will inevitably ensue. In an interview with Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men, he talked about the current state of political correctness and said, quote, "Right now the public conversation is Stalinist, and all this outrage and policing and monitoring is strangling our ability to talk to each other," unquote. So again, to anyone in my generation who speaks out for social issues, do we want to be known as the generation that criticizes and belittles people who are culturally ignorant? As the generation that makes people afraid of fully expressing themselves? Or do we want to be known as the generation that brings people together, who breaks down barriers and helps people become more culturally aware in a respectful way? But I do understand and empathize with your pursuits. I understand that there are people in this world who are ignorant, who fail to take the time to educate themselves on cultural sensitivity. I truly believe that your pursuits are admirable and that we should have a more culturally aware society. I understand the power of words and ideas and how what people say and the way they say it is important, and people should be cautious and sensitive to that. It was Samuel Beckett who said, "Words are all that we have." I understand that words have weight and words have power and people have to be sensitive and aware of the words that they use. But I also want you to be vigilant about the language that you use when you speak out publicly. And I also want you to realize the power of one dissenting opinion. And by you, I don't just mean Lexi, I mean everyone who speaks out about cultural issues, especially on social media. The power of one dissenting opinion, regardless of whether that opinion has merit. This idea reminds me of what happened to Bill Maher's show Politically Incorrect on ABC. Wow, that's ironic, the title of the show. Anyway, it was the show he had before Real Time, and this idea of the power of one dissenting opinion reminds me of the reason as to why it got canceled. It happened right after 9/11, and after the attacks, George W. Bush responded by saying that the terrorists responsible for the attacks are cowards. Then on the Politically Incorrect episode that took place on September 17th, 6 days later, A political commentator, Dinesh D'Souza, responded in dispute to Bush's comments and said that he believed that they weren't cowards and I believe called them warriors. Then Bill Maher responded by saying, quote, "We have been the cowards. Lobbing cruise missiles from 2,000 miles away? That is cowardly. Staying in the airplane when it hits the building? Say what you want about it. It's not cowardly." Unquote. Now, immediately after they both said this, no one in the audience audibly responded in a negative way. No one in the crew thought anything of it. There was no direct negative response in the media about it. And even though what Bill Maher was talking about was a sensitive topic, it is my opinion that he had every right to say what he said. However, it took one dissenting opinion. It took one person. One guy in Texas, I think, who was a morning radio host to speak out in disagreement with the comments made on the show. He said that he thought what was said on the show was offensive. And it snowballed from there. Eventually, advertisers started pulling out because they didn't want to look bad. And then the media took attention to it. The White House press secretary at the time spoke out against Bill Maher saying, quote, "People have to watch what they say and watch what they do," unquote. And regardless of Bill Maher apologizing and explaining that he was criticizing America's military policy and not American soldiers, it didn't matter. The show got canceled. All because of it originating from this one man from Texas and his dissenting opinion. Now, the reason that I am saying this is because obviously it reminds me of what happened to the event Queso for Casa. They had been doing the event for years with the Mexican food. They had the poster on Facebook that year. I don't know if it had always been the same poster every year, but before Lexi spoke out, no one expressed the opinion that they found it to be offensive. And then once she did, it snowballed, and the situation became what it became. Lexi tweeted after the event's cancellation saying, quote, "FYI, one person finding something offensive doesn't result in an event being canceled," unquote. But I disagree with her. I think history shows that there is great power in one person's opinion. So the reason I am telling this story is because I want people to realize the power they have. Especially with the internet, every individual has the power to cause change with his or her opinion, especially when it's an opinion of disagreement. The power of one dissenting opinion. So again, to anyone in my generation who utilizes the internet to speak out for what you believe, understand the power that you have. Don't take advantage of it. Use it to create positivity. Use it to empathize. I understand that it is unfair that your pursuits are often responded to with hostility and bullying, but don't stoop to their level. Use the power of your voice respectfully. Don't use it to shame. Use it for good. And if you want to speak out with a dissenting opinion, make sure you truly believe in it. And to Lexi, as I said, this has not been an attempt to make you look bad. It's not as if I'm accusing you of being immoral. I truly believe, or at least hope, that your heart is in the right place. And as I said before, I genuinely find your pursuits admirable, and I actually truly believe that you have the intelligence and the passion to do great things in this world. I am doing this because I feel as if I needed to finally speak out about what I believed and speak out in a way that I have been afraid to before. And give a voice, hopefully a respectful and diplomatic one, to the other side of the argument. So I don't know why you changed your mind, and I don't know why after 4 months of displaying nothing but enthusiasm for being a guest on my podcast, you have now communicated to me that you don't want to be a part of it because you don't want to do a favor for someone who wasn't very nice to you in college. If you're referring to the tweet that I sent at you, I apologize. It was an emotional and unfair reaction to disagreeing with one of your opinions. If you're referring to something else that I don't remember, then I apologize for that. In the past, I have unfairly assumed who you are and what makes you you. So instead of me assuming, please come on my podcast so I can talk to you about all of this and find out about the real you and have a discussion about political correctness and its connection to our generation, as I believe it is a very important conversation to have. Okay, that is all. Thank you to everyone who stuck around and listened to that. I promise that from now on, the show will primarily be focused on the interviews, unless in the future I feel passionate enough to devote as much time to a topic as I did today. And now, let's finally get to my conversation with the lovely Stephanie Damiano.
So, well, first of all, I want to thank you for coming.
Yeah, you're so welcome.
I don't think we've actually ever had this, probably the longest conversation we've ever had.
I know it is.
Yeah.
Well, I always knew you.
Yeah, I knew of you. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's Steph. Yeah. We've talked over text. Yeah. But yeah, thank you. When I asked you to come, you were like, I only have this hour free. What is so busy about your life right now that you...
It's so busy. I have school full time.
Oh, you're still in school?
Well, I graduated Montclair in May.
Yeah.
And then I went to grad school, NYU, September. So
What?
Yeah.
For what?
For clinical social work.
Oh.
Yeah. So
I had no idea.
That's taking up so much of my time. Plus, I'm not going to give up the industry because the whole acting, modeling, dancing thing is my number one passion.
Yeah.
I always said if Hollywood came knocking on my door tomorrow, I'd be out of the social work field, which is awful.
I agree.
To say, but that's always been my number one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So clinical social work is number two. And then I'm a dance teacher.
Oh, really? Where?
So it's claim to fame. It's brand new. I studied with the person, Shannon, who opened it up. She was on So You Think You Can Dance. So she opened up her own studio and we trained together. And
where is that?
Her studio. Butler.
Located Butler. Mm-hmm. Wow. You teach little kids?
I do, yeah.
Are they annoying?
No, they're so cute.
They're cute. Well, that's good. It's glad that you're keeping busy.
It's busy.
How long is the social work thing? Is that 3 year, 2 years?
2 years. So I want to get my doctoral degree because I'm the first person in my family that went to college. So I figured, thank you. I figured it was kind of like go hard or go home.
Oh, it's a doctorate? That's right.
Right now it's a master's, but then it will transition. So the master's program itself is 2 years. So basically when I'm done, I sit for my L. So then I'm an LSW after I get my master's degree.
Right.
And then I have 300 hours in the field, and then I'll become a C. So I have my LCSW, and then I can go for my DSW, which is an additional 3 years, which is my doctoral degree.
So many acronyms.
Yeah, I know.
So wait, where are you commuting to New York?
Commuting.
Wow. Yeah. From where do you, are you live in Montclair?
No, I live in Bloomingdale still my parents. Yep.
Yeah,
so,
with the parents.
The rents.
How often do you have to go into New York?
For the industry, I'll go maybe twice a week, and for school, it's twice a week.
Yeah.
So I'm there most of the time. It would make sense to move.
Yeah.
Kind of.
So you usually go on like two auditions a week?
I don't audition anymore, which is like so sad to say because I miss it. But
well, so what does that mean? What do you do?
So I'll do direct booking, and like I've networked a lot in the industry, so I'm kind of getting the jobs through direct bookings, referrals, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Come summertime when I do have the availability, I will audition again.
Yeah.
But, as for now, when I'm in school, I'm just kind of hustling through the direct bookings.
So wait, so the auditioning isn't necessary? Like you still could audition just because you don't have the time?
Yeah, it's just the time. So right now I'm doing the industry part-time. Summer will be full-time again with auditions, and I'll be in the city 5 to 6 times a week again. So
wow. Well, I a big reason I wanted to have you on is because obviously I'm interested in all that type of stuff too, even though I talk to people who are into whatever. But and I just wanted to get to know you. Because, like I said, this is the longest conversation.
This is the longest conversation ever.
Yeah. But I am interested in how you got involved with the modeling thing, like where it started, why you wanted to do it. Was it a thing if your parents made you do it, or like did you just want to do it?
Actually, it was the opposite. So when I was in 7th grade, I got scouted at a dance competition for A Wish Come True. It's like this big, it's known in the dance world as like a big catalog costume book.
Okay.
So basically, like, everyone orders their recital of costumes from this book. So they were at a dance competition, and they kind of scouted me. I told my mom.
Yeah.
And mind you, I was in the 7th grade, so I needed a signature to be able to, like, have them take my picture and my measurements and all that. My mom said, absolutely not. It's a scam. Don't do it. So I was crying hysterical because I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
So I had my dance teacher pretend that she was my mother. So I had her walk over and sign as my mother.
Wow.
And the only reason she agreed is because I won the competition. So it was kind of like, if you win, then fine.
Yeah.
But if you don't win, then I'm not doing it. And I happened to win, so she did it. And so she signed. They took my pictures. They took my measurements. The week after, I got a phone call from them. My mom answered the phone because it was my home phone number. I didn't have a cell phone. And my mom wanted to kill me. So she basically... ripped me a new one. And she was like, don't you dare go behind my back, blah, 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 blah. I cried again. And I was like, but mommy, this is something I really want, please. So she was like, okay, fine. The audition in person is in Pennsylvania. That's where the fitting is. She goes, I will allow you to take off of school. I will take off of work just so I could like show you mommy's always right. I was like, okay. So I was in my head like, oh my God, I really hope mommy's never like always right. Because if she's going to be wrong, this is going to be the one time.
Yeah.
So mommy was wrong. I went there. I tried on the costume. We left. And I left with a four-year contract. So I did this up to sophomore year of high school.
Yeah.
So, yeah, every month I'd come in. I'd model their new costumes. I booked a cover with them. I booked a lot of pages doing just modeling for their clothes. So that was 4 years straight.
Wow.
Then after the contract expired, it was for kids. So I developed into like a woman.
Yeah.
And I didn't look like a child anymore. So I did not resign and I just pursued dancing until senior year.
It was a child management. So when you say, well, I have a few questions.
Mm-hmm.
Scouting.
Mm-hmm.
What did they like when you in the moment, what did they specifically do? They just come up to you?
They approach you. Yeah, they'll approach you.
How were they there? They just like,
well, because it was a dance competition and they're a pretty known like dance costume catalog company.
Oh,
they were
the company is a dance costume modeling company.
Right. So I didn't have an agency. I didn't have a manager at the time.
Oh.
It was the company itself that kind of introduced themselves to me.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So up until seventh grade, you just were a dancer.
Yeah.
Oh,
just
wow,
a dancer.
Wow,
I did like community theater fun because I liked it, but I never wanted to make it a career.
Yeah.
It was kind of just fun and in the community and something my mom enrolled me in, and I just kind of stuck with it.
Yeah.
But then,
so yeah, 4 years later.
4 years later, I'm a sophomore in high school. I did not renew the contract because I was a woman and it was a children's clothing company. And then I kind of just was fine competitive dancing again. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a huge loss on my end. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to compete after a senior year of high school. That's the cutoff for competitive dancing. Once you go to college, you're considered an adult and you don't compete as an adult. So I went to college. I lived there. Within my first maybe 2 weeks of school, a drunk girl that I've never met before came knocking on my dorm room and she was like, I think you're really pretty, but like I'm really drunk and I know that you're not going to trust me, but I took your pictures off of your Facebook page and I sent it to my manager who's the head booker at MMG New York City. She was drunk. I never met her in my life and I was just like, okay.
Wow.
She showed up the next day sober
at
my dorm.
How did she have connection with the head booker?
It was her cousin.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So she showed up at my door sober the next day. And she's like, no, but seriously, like, this is actually happening. She's like, here's my cousin's information. Head booker, New York City. Get in touch with her. Send her pictures. And that person has been my manager ever since.
Wow. Mm-hmm. What luck.
Yeah. So
that's
it was
incredible.
Pure luck both times.
So when you stopped after the 4 years, what, you were a sophomore or a junior in high school?
Sophomore in high school.
Yeah. And then you just junior and senior of high school, you just danced?
Yeah, I didn't care to. It was just kind of like, all right, this is over. You know, it's not like I wanted to or could pursue it at that point. I had no manager, no nothing.
Yeah.
So I just sat with it, danced.
Yeah.
Dance was like always my number one passion. I was content. And then it kind of fell into place again. And I was like, okay, there's a reason this keeps happening. And I pursued it.
Yeah, that's interesting because when I was in seventh grade, I actually got scouted by a talent manager when I was doing theater for for the Boys and Girls Club, whatever production. And I signed a contract. It was only for 2 years. And I just went on like a bunch of commercial auditions, a few pilots, but a bunch of commercial auditions. I never booked anything, but I kind of like started to increasingly decline wanting to go on auditions. I don't know if I necessarily got like fed up with the rejection, but I was like, do I really want to do this? Keep doing this still? And then by that time, I think I was like about to enter high school. I was like, do I really want to? I kind of want to be like every other high school student. I don't want to just, you know, have to be in the city every like every week. Did you throughout those 4 years at any time be like, oh God, should I be doing this still? Was there any like moment of doubt or was it a smooth sailing?
There wasn't, but I was rejected at certain points.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was in seventh grade, I wasn't weight conscious at all. I mean, now like I'll stick to a diet and exercise. And
oh my God,
pretty,
we gotta talk all about
top.
Weight consciousness.
Yeah, but when I was in seventh grade, like I was told at some point, you know, you need to lose weight. And
yeah.
It's like, how do you tell a seventh grader she needs to lose weight? You don't.
Yeah.
And I remember I used to take dance classes and I'd have to wear a belt. And we'd tick mark where I was on the belt hole. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to get a whole size down within the end of the year. So that was kind of rough. But I mean, only at that point did I get kind of upset about it. Because I liked how I was and they didn't. So it was kind of that whole rejection piece. But at no point did I let it stop me. It didn't hinder me. It kind of motivated me a little to kind of be like, you know, I'll show you, you know, I'll get down on that belt hole and like, I'll book more jobs. And it turned into a healthy consciousness now that I think maybe wouldn't have been so healthy if it wasn't forced early on and I didn't have the ability to kind of reject them forcing me. So I think right now it kind of worked for the best.
Yeah.
But I could see how maybe someone else, it would backfire and lead to whole other mental health issues that I'm working with clients now who are dealing with mental health issues.
Yeah, child actors, some of them obviously grow up to, I guess it's like the attention, the spotlight, your brain isn't fully developed enough to be able to handle that. And you get this kind of like inflated view of yourself and just, and it goes all downhill from there. But yeah, like you said, it's lucky that it didn't happen to you.
Yeah.
So you said throughout that when you're junior and senior year, you weren't missing it? Were you like, I should be still doing it? You were content with everything?
Yeah, I was content. I mean, my dance schedule kind of picked up. I took on a second solo. I was competing a lot more. I was going for national titles. So it wasn't really that I had enough time to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And I like being busy. So dance kept me busy and it wasn't like anything was missing. I think the busyness just kind of made everything else flow in my life that I didn't have time to think like that I missed anything because my days were filled. I mean, I was doing homework in the car on the way to and from dance. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I had time to think about it.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily notice it was missing.
Cool. So. Well, so then you went to Montclair. Mm-hmm. You lived there?
I lived there the first year. Yep.
And then so going to college, you obviously didn't expect what happened to happen.
Not at all.
So what were your expectations for college? What were you hoping college would be?
Well, because I went to Catholic school my whole life, I think my mom tried to kind of shelter me in that way. Like I don't necessarily think I chose Catholic school. I think my mom wanted to keep, I'm her only child. So she wanted to preserve the innocence and that whole nine. Mm-hmm. So I think because I was going to a public, big, huge college and college has the stigma of partying that I probably would have followed. I think she made me do a beauty pageant, just one. Because she thought that it would kind of be like something cool to have on my resume when I was applying to colleges. So I did it and I won the title of USA National Miss New Jersey. So
when was this?
2011 to 2012. So right when I was graduating high school and entering college. So she made me keep that title for the full year. I committed to it. You know, I wasn't going to back down. I won, whatever. Like I just wanted to make mom happy at this point. So that
I'll just win a beauty pageant contest real quick. No big deal.
And it had money attached to it for a scholarship.
Cool.
So that's kind of my piece of doing it because I was paying for college on my own.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, fine. Like I'll appease mom. Yeah. I'll get the title.
Make her happy.
And get money. So like we both
get
benefit.
Paid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I wasn't expecting to have that party life because I knew that some way I was in the spotlight from that. Mm-hmm. And I attribute that to kickstarting my modeling career as well, because from there I got professional pictures taken that I was able to send to the manager when it came time.
Right.
So, you know, when the crazy drunk girl came knocking on my door, I was able to have those pictures. Uh-huh. So I think without that, I mean, I would have been kind of stuck because I would have had selfies. Like I wouldn't have had professional pictures taken. But I think mom made me do the beauty pageant to preserve my innocence. So I couldn't be caught at a party with a beer in my hands. You know, I couldn't be caught at 4:30 in the morning still being out. I had to make sure that I maintained my grades, which I did. I ended up graduating with a 4.0 in my major, so that was kind of cool.
Whoa.
Yeah. I'm kind of like a nerd a little bit.
Really?
Yeah.
Like you like to really try hard?
I do. I mean,
is it like a thing where you want to do well or?
It's like me being a perfectionist, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I had that.
I wish I didn't have that because.
No, you're lucky. Trust me. Yeah.
Yeah. It gets the best of you sometimes.
Though, yeah, I understand.
But.
Yeah.
Yeah, the crazy work ethic.
So this thing happens where you get to hook up the modeling agency hookup. You just dove right in.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just
no
was
hesitation.
Seamless. No, it was I took the contract to a lawyer. My mom's a paralegal, so that was kind of just easy. It didn't really I just handed it to her, and at that point my mom's like, you're an adult, you know, I'm not carting your ass to the city in and out, you know, you're going to be responsible for yourself.
Yeah.
And luckily the Montclair train station was walking distance from my dorm room. So that's what I did. I had the lawyer look at the contract. Everything was all cut and dry. Everything was fine.
Yeah.
And I took myself to the city.
Yeah,
and
out. You think the handling of a modeling career or trying to have a modeling career while being at college, was it difficult or was it something that since you were so passionate for it, you didn't even...
At first, it was difficult. At first, I think I was just caught up in that moment of like, oh my God, this is how it's supposed to happen. You know, you're supposed to get discovered in a way. You always hear famous people getting discovered. So I kind of just thought that this was going to be it. You know, Hollywood's going to knock on my door. And I fell into that kind of hole. I didn't realize how much work it would be. Because Crazy Drunk Girl knocked on my door, it was kind of just like all the excitement. And then when I realized, okay, like you're gonna go on a million auditions and you're probably gonna book one, that's when I realized like, oh crap, like this is intense, like you really got to work for it. So that's when I'd have to, you know, set aside, besides taking max credits at school, you'd kind of have to set aside time to memorize some scripts and some lines. And
yeah,
you know, the commuting wasn't a simple commute.
No.
It was kind of just over an hour on the train and memorizing lines there. But then, you know, I have a paper due tomorrow that I didn't start yet. And it just, it played into the whole me trying to be a perfectionist in everything I did.
Yeah. Well,
so it
it's, you obviously balanced it well because you ended up getting 4.0 in your major and you still got some work from what I've heard.
Yeah.
So that's
far,
awesome.
So good.
Well, so like now looking back at it, how do you value your college experience and what you've got out of it, just the college experience? I mean, I know it's probably hard to separate it from the modeling thing because they coincided, they happened at the same time, but overall, what did you get from Montclair? What did you get from the college experience?
I had a good college experience. I didn't necessarily want to go to Montclair. I actually wanted to go to Marist.
Oh, wow.
And I got into Marist, but for some odd reason, I was like, all right, you know what? Like Montclair is local. A couple of my best friends were going to Montclair.
Yeah.
So I figured Montclair. I think I would have been a completely different person today if I did go to Marist or any other college because I wouldn't have had that girl knocking on my door. So I don't think I'd be in the position I'm in now.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful that I went to Montclair. I had a great 3.5 years there.
Mm-hmm. Three and a half.
Well, I graduated early.
Oh.
I forgot to add that piece.
Why? Because you're a nerd?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Did you have credits coming in?
No.
Oh, you just took classes super quick.
I didn't take any summer. I didn't take any winter.
So how'd you do that?
So part of my nerdiness was to figure out the math behind it. So I picked a major that I was interested in. And it was a fairly new major. It was child advocacy and policy.
Right.
So it didn't have as many credits as my psychology major that I declared going in.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to swap the two. So I was a child advocacy and policy major. I was a psych minor and I was a dance minor. So the way the credits all worked out, I met the required amount and I was able to max out every semester. So it just happened that it had to be 3.5 years, but I did the math to the credits and had to advocate for myself to take 7 classes in my last semester at Montclair.
You were clever.
The dean wasn't too happy about, but it worked.
Yeah.
And it just worked. And then I had a semester off to work full time and do the industry stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
I should have looked into something like that.
Most people say that now. I think it was just luck, to be honest.
Oh, you have a lot of luck.
Yeah. I won't win the lottery, but for this stuff, it's
yeah, right? I was really banking on winning the lottery.
The billions of dollars.
Oh, my God. The one that just, yeah. You ever convince yourself, like, start thinking about what you do with all that money and you, like, subconsciously convince yourself that it's possible and that you're going to win and you just start planning your life as if it's definitely going to happen?
That's exactly what I did. Well, don't forget, I mean, before I came here today, I do therapy. I do psychotherapy as, you know, part of my internship.
Oh, God, are you judging me?
No, not at all. Everyone says that. They're like, are you analyzing me?
Yeah.
I mean, like, I say no, but, like, sometimes yes. But you're fine. You're
okay,
reading.
Cool.
And your affect is great.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's great.
But like I had
good to know.
The night of the drawing, I had a talk with all my patients and like it became so real to me. I'm like, yeah, I probably won't see you Monday, guys, because I'm going to win the lottery and I won't need to go to school anymore. And then Monday comes and it's like I didn't even get one number.
Yeah, I already planned. I was like, I'm building a little studio in my backyard and I'm just going to do nothing but this podcast for the rest of my life and not have to worry about money. Yeah,
my goals were like out the window.
Yeah, right. But anyway, maybe someday. Probably not, though.
Yeah, probably not.
So I was looking at some of your credits. It feels cool to be able to say that. So wait, so what were some of the cool things that you booked while at college? Some of the experiences you've had?
While at college? Well, I booked a movie that hasn't come out yet that I had to miss class for. And I never, ever, ever miss class because I'm a perfectionist. Obviously, we established that. But I told the teacher that I was really sick and that I had the stomach virus. But instead, I drove myself to Port Washington and we filmed this movie coming out.
Where's that?
New York. It's like kind of by Long Island, exit 36, on the LIE, I believe.
Yeah.
I'm not good at direction, so that could be totally wrong.
Directionally challenged.
I hope you're not taking them. No. So yeah, it was in Long Island, and I drove myself there. I stayed there 2 days, and that was my first movie set I ever did.
You were just on the shoot for 2 days?
For 2 days. Yeah. Yep. And it's called The Outskirts. It's coming out supposedly this year. It was supposed to come out right before Creed last year. It was supposed to come out November 6th, and Creed came out Thanksgiving. So I thought it was cool that my first movie and my last movie were coming out within weeks of each other, but it didn't work like that. So it's supposed to be coming out soon. And
what was the part? What did you do?
I was in Peyton List's posse, because it's kind of like Revenge of the Nerds. It's starring Victoria Justice, Avon Jogia, List. So Peyton List, like the cool popular girl. And I was in her posse. It was a little small part.
Yeah.
But then Victoria Justice was a nerd. And it was, you know.
How did that happen?
Yeah, I know.
That'd be a lot of costume for that.
Yeah, she's flawless. I mean, she's beautiful.
Yeah.
Clearly you think so too.
Yeah.
But when she was on set, like, she was the biggest nerd ever. She was
really
just able to get in character. And it was just so impressive to me that she was able to act out her part throughout the entire time I was talking to her. It was like seamless for her. And then it's like, you know, hair and makeup gets taken away, and then she's back to being beautiful. And it's like, oh my God, it was just amazing to be able to see the transition.
Yeah.
It was
That's crazy. Well, that's cool. That was your first movie shoot.
Yeah.
Did you do anything? So you did Creed.
I did Creed.
Did you film that after? Was that filmed after
Creed
college?
Yeah, Creed was actually last year. It took less than a year for Creed to come out.
Yeah.
It was a quick shoot.
Yeah. Did you get any, you were a ring girl?
I was a ring girl.
Were you in the movie?
I'm visible. I mean, don't blink, but I'm visible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had some people, I was supposed to go to the premiere for it, but of course, because it was so far, I couldn't go.
It was in LA?
Yeah, there was one in LA, and then they did another one in Philly. So I couldn't go to either.
Oh, obviously Philly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I regret not going.
Yeah.
But I had school, you know, I was in grad school. It was like, I had to kind of sacrifice that because I didn't really want to miss class or midterms or finals. And
you nerd,
I know,
passing up the movie premiere.
I know, it's
okay.
So bad.
Did you get to have any conversations with Michael B. Jordan or Sylvester Stallone or Ryan Coogler, the director?
All of them, yeah.
I love Ryan Coogler.
Cool. Oh my God, he was great.
What was any thing that happened with them?
Well, it was really cool because I don't know if there's any behind the scene video of this. So I was sitting ringside with Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah.
For the first fight. So he's wearing like a little bumblebee outfit, I call it, in the first fight. It's black and yellow. But
okay.
I was like, you look like a bumblebee. Like, he was very playful. So it was easy to mess around with him. So it was the first fight that the movie ever shown. And he was on set with me. Sylvester Stallone wasn't there yet.
Mm-hmm.
Sylvester got called onto set, and everybody, and this was a huge fight scene. So like the whole auditorium was filled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were obviously shooting in Philly. I forget what college it was, but we were shooting in some like huge arena.
Yeah.
Every seat was filled with extras. The minute Sylvester Stallone came out, like,
roarious applause.
Oh my God. Just everyone standing ovation. And he was so humble too. And
yeah,
he was actually so shy, which was kind of different than I expected him.
Yeah.
And he was just, you know, clapping back at the audience and saying thank you and blowing kisses and bowing. And it was literally like a 5-minute entrance because everyone was just on the edge of their seat, if not standing. And it was just, it was so surreal. Like, I got the chills from it because it was like, wow, this man is so humble. And like, he really doesn't have to be because he's a legend. And
yeah.
It was nice to see him being like that.
Because
I've worked with other celebs who don't have his status that weren't so
humble.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to give me any names. But yeah, I definitely detected that because he won a few of those awards, even though he didn't win the Oscar. He got snubbed. But he won like the Golden Globe, and his reaction seemed genuinely like he was very surprised and very grateful. So he seems like a good guy.
He was.
Well, that's cool that you got that experience.
Yeah.
So in between those two movies, what else have you done? Wait, I have your credits. Let's see.
Oh, boy.
Let's see. Outskirts. What is Geezer?
Oh, God. Okay, so Geezer is a movie. I had to be a punk rocker. So like sitting across from me in a suit, like you wouldn't think that I could be a punk rocker. And I didn't either, to be honest.
Yeah.
And then after I left makeup and hair, and they gave me a fake nose ring and like really dark makeup and really dark clothes, I like probably pulled it off if I couldn't talk. because I think
I
don't sound like a punk rocker.
You have dark features too, because you're like brown hair, brown eyes. Yeah.
And my skin's light, so it kind of adds into the whole grungy look. Yeah. So I pulled it off. But yeah, so that I had a minor role. I was just a punk rocker and I made fun of Billy Joel, who's, you know, the lead singer of Green Day in it. I passed up his little kitty guitar. But yeah, it was just like making fun of him because he hits like a midlife crisis. He realizes that he's not the lead singer of Green Day anymore. He's been replaced. He finds out on his 40th birthday. So I was just kind of the girl who embarrassed him by bringing him, you know, his little kitty guitar with dinosaur stickers on it and making fun of him during the party.
That's cool. You gotten to do a lot of cool stuff. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So obviously, you're 22 years old, right?
23.
23.
As of November.
Yeah. Do you notice is there a noticeable difference between the way models or people in the model industry are treated in our generation, or is there like a difference between the model industry for people in our generation than the generations previous? How has it changed for like people our age, if it has at all?
That's interesting. Something that I've noticed is I've gotten a lot of feedback from makeup artists and directors, kind of shocked that I'm compliant and that I'm not on my phone and that I'm not like, you know, phone absorbed, social media absorbed while I'm on set.
Right.
And that's a comment I've gotten a lot. And I didn't really parallel what you're saying to this, but like now I am making the connection. Mm-hmm. I think that for our generation, I don't know that we're taken as seriously because of social media, because of like, you know, trying to sneak selfies on set, you know, just that kind of thing. I think they maybe think we're more unprofessional than the generation who showed up to work and didn't have other distractions.
Yeah.
Or societal expectations. I mean, like, you know, the Instagram model thing, you got to get that perfect picture.
Yeah.
I think in that light, we're treated different.
Yeah, but maybe they assume that we're more obsessed with like celebrity culture, and maybe they assume that certain people's intentions aren't for necessarily that they love the work and love what they do, and more for just like superficial reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess isn't fair, obviously, because there's people like you who aren't like that. But it's cool that people realize that everyone isn't like that.
Yeah. I mean, I could definitely appreciate that sense of it. When you're saying it, it definitely rings a bell. You know, I can think of other people who I've worked with.
Yeah.
That resonates with me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that even the makeup artists pick up on it. And they'll make comments like, oh, you're not like the last girl I worked with who was on her phone. I could barely do her eyeshadow. It was very distracting. It took a long time. Actually, I was on set with a director who's pretty known in like the food industry. He does a lot of things for Baskin and Robbins, Dunkin' Donuts, a lot of advertisements that way. Mm-hmm. So you'll never hear of him like, you know, on a feature film or TV, but he's like the behind the scenes of advertisements.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked with him because I was working for a project with Boar's Head in early January. So basically the idea is they're going to not keep the people who cut and order cold cuts for other people in certain supermarkets.
Mm-hmm.
So they're replacing them with me. And I'm this figure named Allison. And it's this really cool concept of kind of like digital marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So they made a hologram of me and I had lines and I take deli orders. So you can get a sandwich through me. You can order your cold cuts through me. And I'm a hologram and I'm like this glass cutout. And there was a lot of lines associated with it. I got the job maybe a week prior to filming. So it was like pages of scripts and it was very precise and, you know, there was a lot of body language choreographed. So it was not, I mean, the easiest thing I've done. It was definitely one of the most cool, like, it was the coolest thing I've done, but hard.
Yeah.
Because I've never done something like that before. And I was the only lead on set.
Right.
So the director said to me, you know, I've worked with models before in the past who really rely on teleprompters. Feel free to, you know, memorize the script. But you don't have to because there'll be a teleprompter there. And, you know, expect the shoot to take like 8 to 10 hours. So in my head, I'm like, you know, that sounds crazy. 8 to 10 hours.
Yeah, wow.
Like, you know, if I just memorize this, it could be done in 4.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did. So when I came to set, he was like, okay, let me hook up the teleprompter. I have it in my car, blah, blah, blah. I was like, actually, like, I really don't think I need the teleprompter. And he's like, really? I was like, yeah, like, I really don't think I need it. I think I'm pretty set in these lines. He was like, well, when did you memorize them? I was like, I've been. Like, you know, as soon as I got the script, I've been going over the lines. I'm pretty confident in them. So he was like, okay, you know, we'll try it, but if you need the teleprompter, let me know. So I was on set. I didn't need the teleprompter at all. Like, I never really messed up my lines. And he was just so impressed with, wow, like, how did you like remember these lines? And I'm like, it's, you know, what did they do before the teleprompter? Yeah. It's kind of just easier to rely on your own memory,
yeah,
rather than going from the teleprompter, you know, back and forth. So he was impressed in what you were raising the question of, that I was able to do that being so young in the industry. And he said that usually, you know, people don't care enough. If they know that there's a teleprompter, then they won't go through the hassle of memorizing the lines. So, I mean, yeah, to answer your question, there was an expectation that because I'm so young, because I got the lines a week before, which in my aspect, it's kind of fair to get them a week before. That's not like, you know, late at all.
No, no, no. Some people get them the day of.
The day before. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So in that experience, he was kind of, you know, like, I'll definitely use you again. This is great. We ended the shoot in 4 hours. They upped my pay. So it was good on both ends.
Yeah, it's from everything I've heard, it's great to do stuff like that. It's great to show that you work hard and you care, because you never know who's there working and what other opportunity could come from it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're a smart one.
Thanks.
Well, that seems like an experience that was good. But do you have any horror stories that happened? Do you have any times where you were mistreated? Or that
horror
you were...
stories.
Or any like times where you're like, this doesn't feel right.
Actually... yeah, I do. And my mom doesn't know about this one, so I hope that she doesn't listen to this. But so it was when I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
So I started the career when I was 18. I'm 23 now. So it's like, you know, my midpoint. I had a photo shoot in Queens, and I won't say the photographer's name because that would be pretty bad.
Yeah.
But he was a great photographer, and I noticed his work. He asked to shoot with me. I was shooting with a model who I'd really wanted to work with. I still keep in touch with him. He's great.
Mm-hmm.
He's very professional. And at the time, he had more experience than I did. So he came on set maybe an hour later because I had to get hair and makeup done. So it was just the photographer and
guys have it so much easier.
Yeah, they do. They do. So he his call time was like an hour and a half later than mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I get to set. I have a makeup artist there who he's never worked with before either. I hired her because I like to bring my own makeup artist. They know my face, you know. I brought the makeup artist. He was on set just talking about this horror story that I was petrified hearing. And he was saying how, you know, don't judge him, but he got arrested once because some guy was raping some girl in his room during a party recently. And he decided to take the guy and not only beat him up, but tie him to the back of his pickup truck and ride down the street with him. So the guy got really hurt.
Oh my God. So the back of a, not like, so he was like tied in a rope from the back of the truck.
Yes.
He wasn't in the truck. He was
he was dragging.
Being dragged.
Him. Yeah.
So okay.
Dragging him.
So all right.
He's telling me this. And the moral of the story was, you know, he likes precision and he likes, you know, things to be right and on his terms.
Right.
And
I guess
basically forewarning me that like these are the images he's going for and like get them or he's going to get angry. And when he gets angry, he takes it over the top sometimes. And
wow.
That was his example of that. So in my head, like I was confident in myself to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And I was confident in the male model because he's great. You know, I've worked with him. He's awesome. So when he was telling me that, I was like, oh my God, like, what if the sun's not setting right? Like, you know, what if the lighting's not okay? He's going to get angry. And he just exampled like this horror story that I don't even want to know.
Yeah.
So he's like, all right, let me go pick the male model up from the train station. I'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Long story short, he goes. The makeup artist is looking at me like, I don't feel safe right now. I was like, neither do I. And I've never left a shoot ever. I was like, should we leave? Like, I will really just peace out right now because I don't feel safe.
What prompted you to not feel safe?
His story.
Oh, okay. It was just after you heard, you were just like, okay. Okay, yes. Yeah, continue.
So he left. So the makeup artist and I had the conversation. I was like, you know what? Let me go take a walk around his house. Now, my father's a police officer. I know guns. I've worked a gun before. I know how to check to see if they're loaded.
Yeah, I've seen your dad on Cops before.
Yeah.
I remember I was watching Cops with my friend at college and I saw Damiano and I was like, wait, what? And I texted Ben, my brother, to see if it was him. And he was like, yeah, that's him.
Yep. And then Ben tweets me like, your dad's on. He does it all the time.
That's great.
So I've worked a gun before. Like I know all about guns because my dad's a cop.
Mm-hmm.
I went and I checked around his house. Sure enough, I was in his living room.
So the shoot was at his house?
He has a studio in his house, so it wasn't like that weird.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
It was outside in Queens. So like we were just gonna set up and meet at his house, in his studio. So I checked, and around the corner from his kitchen was like this little closet, and he had a huge gun in his closet. So now like I heard the story, Now he has a gun. He's like forewarning me that he gets angry really quickly. God. And his anger escalates. The gun was huge. It was like an AK-47.
No way.
Okay, so not that intense, but like it looked
isn't
like
that illegal? Like really automatic weapons?
Yeah. So I got freaked out. So I took the gun and I unloaded it and I put the bullets in my pocket and then I set the gun back just in case anything happened. I mean, he ended up being a really nice guy. He never got angry.
That's so
we got
badass
great
that you know how to do that. You got great shots.
I still have the gun bullets as a souvenir of that.
No way. He has no idea. Well, he obviously knows.
He probably has a great idea, but
you
probably
wouldn't
associate.
Stole the gun bullets.
Yeah, I did.
That is a great story.
I was sweating. I didn't know what to do. So that was the only horror experience I've had. But
wow, you got out alive.
Yeah, I'm alive.
That's crazy.
And I got great pictures, so.
That's great. What was it for?
It was just for, actually, I was supposed to go to India. So there were pictures that I was supposed to shoot, I think, 7 jeans in India for 6 months by my last semester of college.
Yeah.
So it was either India for 6 months or college for my last 6 months. And the nerd in me picked college. But the pictures were an audition for India, which I did book. And then, you know, I never thought I'd get it. Yeah. So I kind of booked it. And then it got very surreal that... I was actually going to go if I was given a withdrawal, like my money back from college.
Right.
But the dean didn't grant it because it was a day late. India was supposed to let me know September 10th. I'll never forget.
Damn it,
and they
India.
Let me know September 11th. So India kind of messed up on that. I had an apartment. They got me a Persian cat. I had a car.
Oh, my God.
And I was just supposed to shoot there for 6 months.
Well, it's okay. You would have had to get a bunch of shots anyway. You would have had to adjust the food. It's weird. It's probably worked out for the best.
Yeah, and I graduated college, so it was fine.
Yeah. Well, that's a crazy story. That's awesome. I'm so glad you told that, even though your mom doesn't know about it. Hopefully, maybe she won't listen. But
yeah, I won't tell her.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so... Now you're in grad school.
Mm-hmm.
You're going on auditions. We usually end for like a hopes for the future thing.
Mm.
What do you? So you wanna get the doctor degree, the doctorate.
I do.
Yeah, but what else? You're just hoping to keep going on more shoots, doing more stuff.
Yeah. I mean, summer I don't have a full time job in line. This is gonna be my full time job. So I'm just kind of hoping that I book something big and consistent, and you know, I wouldn't mind flying out anywhere, specifically to LA. That would be great.
I gotta get out of there too. Yeah, I gotta get out there.
Field trip.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's my hope for the summer. I mean, I have a good 4 months off. I want to do something big, long term.
Mm-hmm.
I'm already putting applications in there. I know that America's Next Top Model is coming back. Last season I auditioned. I was scouted on Instagram, actually. Someone
really?
In the casting department asked me to audition. I did. I made it through all the steps except for the last one. They didn't pick me. They were supposed to fly me out.
Damn it, Tyra.
I know. So I'm pursuing that again.
That's
and
cool.
Hopefully, you know, they're accepting short girls because I'm only 5'3". So
oh,
last
really?
Season was
notice.
Not too short, not too tall. So that's why I was able to audition.
Wow.
So hopefully this time it's the same rules, but fingers crossed.
Yeah. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Wait, so I forgot. I wanted to ask you. I wanted to talk to you about this whole having to maintain a certain body image, because I'm starting to have to deal with that too. I actually just, well, hopefully, I'm hoping it's like legitimate. I just signed with a talent management company.
No way.
Chelsea Talent in New York City.
Good for you.
Hopefully start going on auditions.
Mm-hmm.
And, I remember it was so weird, like being kind of like objectified by like a man, like a 60-year-old man. He like asked me to stand up and he was like, yeah, you got a pretty nice chest. Like maybe work on your abs a little. And I was like, oh God, I thought I was in good shape.
It's funny you say that because it's usually the people that aren't in good shape.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I don't want to, yeah. But yeah, what do you do to maintain a regimen, a diet, workout regimen?
I'm not so crazy in
regimen,
it.
Regimen? Is that the word? I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, I don't know either. I'm not so crazy about it.
Yeah,
well,
that's good.
Yeah. I mean, right now my measurements are 36, 26, 36. So I'm even, which is a good thing. So I think the only time I would have to worry about it is if I'm uneven. But right now, you know, stereotypically, like that Busta Rhymes song, it's like 36, 24, 36, but only achieves 5'3". That's like my goal.
Oh, my God. I had no idea what that meant. Wait, so 36, what does that mean? What are those measurements of?
36? So the chest is 36. The stomach is 24. For me, it's 26 right now. And then the hips are 36. So it's kind of like that hourglass look, which I'm cool going for because it's not like I'm hitting a runway. I'm 5'3". So. Mm-hmm. That's like what I want to market myself as.
Right.
So right now I've been doing the Insanity program and I've been doing it for years.
That's insane. Did you know that?
Yeah, it is insane. I have the t-shirt and everything.
Yeah.
That's like why I did it originally for the t-shirt. It's like really cool. But so I've been doing that consistently. You know, I'll do it and then I'll take a month off and then I'll do it. But I'll stick to kind of like just the healthy eating. Mm-hmm. A lot of protein, not a lot of carbs, every 4 to 5 hours. 5 small meals a day.
Yeah, I do the five small meals too. Yeah, I had I had kind of a ridiculous body transformation.
I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, people, we've never like had a conversation, but like I remember on Facebook, I'd be like, "Wow."
Yeah, people were scared, but I did it right for the most part. Yeah. Went to a nutritionist.
Nice.
And it's funny because I think maybe you can resonate with this. I remember listening to a podcast recently that my friend Mustafa showed me about how, like, people who lose weight, oftentimes it's, like, not a conscious thing of, like, okay, I want to lose weight because, for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually because you have this identity switch.
Mm-hmm.
You start, the only way it can work and you, like, really fully devote yourself to it is if you have a identity switch, because people kind of get caught up in, like not wanting to lose weight because they reaffirm to themselves, oh, I'm like fat, like I don't work out, like I'll never be able to be thin.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like for me, and I didn't even realize I did it, I guess I did it subconsciously, and I realized it once I listened to this podcast, I had this identity switch of like, I want to be someone who could be in front of camera, I want to be an entertainer. I got this late night talk show at school and I was like, if this was a legitimate thing, they would make me lose weight anyway. So people always ask me like, oh, how did you do it? And I would kind of just like, I just kind of like did it. Like it was like from out of nowhere. And they're like, no, but like, how did you do it? Like, what did you do? And I was like, oh, I just went from not working out and not eating well
to doing the opposite.
And they were just so disappointed. They like wanted some like secret. Like, oh, you like, I thought maybe you like drank like moose piss or something. I don't know. And I'm like, no, just the normal way. But yeah, I think especially if anyone's listening and they want to lose weight, you got to stop reaffirming to yourself that it'll never happen. Because once that happens, it's just kind of easy to just switch the mindset. So do you usually have the mindset of like, I want to be in this model industry. Like, this is just something I have to do.
Yeah.
You don't even think about it.
It's literally something you have to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, I'm comparing the mental health field right now, but like, you know, I go to work every day and I counsel people and then I have to write their progress notes and I have to document everything. That's a part of that job. And I consider, you know, maintaining my weight as part of this job. It just kind of comes with the package and you know what you're getting into when you sign up for it in all careers. And this is just a career that you know what you're going to get into.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to, you know, grin and bear it if you can. And there's going to be people who try to knock you down in the industry. Like, I think my belt example was like a good seventh grader wearing a belt to have to like tick mark themselves down.
Yeah.
It's, you know, not the best for your self-esteem. But that's why I think motivation is kind of what drives you in this kind of maintaining body weight. And it's part of the package.
Wanting to work. Yeah, it's part of the job. Well, so you talked about some professional hopes for the future. Do you have any personal hopes for the future that you want to share?
Personal hopes for the future.
Do you see yourself as a person who wants to have a like the American dream, husband, kids?
Yeah, I do.
That's cool.
So like my timeline would be to get married like when I'm 27.
Wow.
And I got
it all figured out.
And I have their names in mind already.
Oh God, yeah.
So but like the typical girl.
Yeah.
Like,
you know,
just plan that all out. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. It's whatever. But
yeah. You get married at 28, it's not the biggest deal.
No,
right?
Instead of 27.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, it seems as if you have a good head on your shoulders, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
In your future endeavors and pursuits, and hopefully we can keep in touch, because it'd be cool to talk to someone who's experiencing similar things as me. And hopefully you don't have any more horror stories, but if you do, I'd like to hear about them. So I can be wary of things that may happen to me.
Yeah. Well, no, best of luck to you too. And obviously, thanks. Of course, you know, any advice I can give you. I think my biggest advice that I can give to you and anyone who's listening that may be interested in pursuing
haircut,
that industry.
Haircut for me, maybe?
No. I mean, maybe like in a week, you're fine. But the biggest advice that I can give is to network.
Yeah.
Because that's how I'm literally getting most of my jobs right now. That's mm-hmm. how I'm able not to audition. And I think that's a big help. And it, especially coming from Jersey, it saves mm-hmm. a lot of money. So stay in touch with every single person that you meet on set, whether they're the makeup artist or mm-hmm. the lead in the show. It's
yeah.
so important because opportunities will present themselves. And if you're marketable for it, you basically got the job. There's yeah. extra pull.
Yeah. Something I've heard is like, make friends with everybody, because even if you don't eventually get an opportunity, even if you never get an opportunity for like bigger things, maybe someone that you became friends with did, and mm-hmm. he'll remember you and be like, come along with me.
Yeah.
So that's definitely true.
Absolutely.
But Steph, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming here. I appreciate it. It was nice talking to you.
You too.
Cool. All right, that is it. Thank you to everyone who has listened to this atypical episode. Thank you to Steph for coming on and sharing some cool stories and experiences you've had in show business. Thank you for offering me some advice. Thank you for being a female voice on this podcast that I have desperately needed and been attempting to get. So, next week we will have another episode next Monday, doing this every Monday. So thank you to the people who have listened. Really appreciate it. All right, guys, have a good week.